Web streaming of 90.3 WPLN-FM is made possible by listener support and by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, the promise of discovery. Learn how you can support this service at NashvillePublicRadio.org.
Welcome to this week's edition of Says You. Public Radio's game with words played before our always enthusiastic audience.
The term a hard-boiled crowd really one to fear.
Right. This week, as always, our panelists will display that facility with language and literature that's become our hallmark.
Now, I'm the person, you know, who buys the same book twice because she doesn't remember what she read. Good luck to me.
It was the best of times. It was the best of times. It was the best of times.
You'll be amazed as, once again, we explain the unexplainable, define the indefinite.
It's hard to describe color to a colorblind person.
Yeah, right. That's right.
It looks just like you don't know.
I'll tell you what it looks like.
So come back in a moment and see if a radio show this daring can survive in this economy. Boy, those underwriting opportunities just drying up after the other.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Obama campaigns in Nevada later today, but otherwise, like GOP hopeful Mitt Romney, he is preparing for this week's presidential debate. Speaking on ABC's This Week, Obama advisor David Plouffe was lowering expectations.
We've believed all along that Governor Romney probably has more benefit out of this debate potentially than we do. But what we're going to tell the American people on Wednesday night, as we have through the whole campaign, is exactly where we are as a country, where we need to go, how we rebuild an economy that makes the middle class secure.
Meanwhile, Romney ally GOP New Jersey Governor Chris Christie offered this optimistic forecast.
Every time Mitt Romney has been confronted in this campaign with one of these moments, he has come through in the debate and performed extraordinarily well, laying out his vision very clearly and also contrasting himself and his vision with whoever his opponent was at that time.
The candidates meet Wednesday in Denver. Envoys representing the institutions lending Greece billions return to that country today to examine new austerity measures. Joanna Kakissis has details.
The lenders are the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. They're known as the Troika. The new measures include new taxes and cuts to public sector wages, pensions, and health care spending. If the Troika approves, the budget goes to Parliament for a vote. Unions have promised strikes and demonstrations in protest. Greece must approve the measures to keep receiving bailout loans, which are saving the country from bankruptcy and a eurozone exit. Germany is lending much of the money. Chancellor Angela Merkel says Greece must stick to austerity in exchange for the aid. But former Finance Minister Peer Steinbrück, who hopes to oust Merkel in elections next year, says Greece should get more time to reform its economy. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
The Russian Orthodox Church is urging members of the Pussy Riot punk band to repent. A spokesman for that church says if they do, it'll be taken into account as they appeal their two-year sentences for performing an anti-Kremlin song at Moscow's main cathedral. More from Jessica Gallagher.
Russia's powerful Orthodox Church says if the women show penitence and reconsider their actions, it shouldn't be left unnoticed. The all-female punk rockers were convicted of hooliganism motivated by religious hatred and sentenced to 2 years in a penal colony. For calling on the Virgin Mary to deliver them from Russian President Vladimir Putin on the altar of Russia's most prominent Orthodox cathedral. They were protesting against the church's support of Putin's presidency. Analysts and lawyers for the women say the charges are politically motivated and show that Putin will not tolerate dissent. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
The U.S. Supreme Court returns tomorrow, the first Monday in October, for a new term. This is NPR. The Obama administration's plan to resume the flow of U.S. financial aid to Egypt has hit a roadblock in Congress. As NPR's Howard Berkus reports, the Republican chair of a House Appropriations Subcommittee has put the funding plan on hold.
Republican Congresswoman Kay Granger of Texas wasted no time when the Obama administration told Congress Friday that it was ready to send $450 million to Egypt. The chair of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Foreign Operations quickly placed a hold on the money, saying the U.S.-Egypt relationship has never been under more scrutiny, and rightly so. That's a reference to concerns over a new Islamist government. Granger said she's not convinced of the need for urgent assistance. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said this week that it was time to return to a billion-dollar aid package for Egypt, given a pending economic crisis. The plan was on hold 18 months during Egypt's political revolution. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Democratic Congressman Jesse Jackson's constituents in Chicago still don't know what his career plans are. He's been on medical leave since June for depression and gastrointestinal ailments. Now his $2.5 million townhouse in Washington is on sale, and he's made no announcements about November. A Jackson aide tells the AP the family hopes that the sale would help pay medical bills. A powerful typhoon that injured dozens of people, caused blackouts, and paralyzed traffic in southern Japan is bearing down now on Japan's western coast. Torrential rain and sudden wind gusts slammed the southern islands of Okinawa. At least one person has been killed. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Esurance, an Allstate company, born online and offering tools and resources for drivers to make decisions about their car insurance at esurance.com.
Welcome to Says You, a game of bluff and bluster, words and whimsy.
Support for Says You in San Francisco comes from the good folks at KQED-FM and the Intercontinental Hotels, the Intercontinental Mark Hopkins, and the Intercontinental San Francisco, our home away from home on the Bay and on the web at intercontinentalsanfrancisco.com.
Now, join our panelists and your host, Richard Scherr.
Thank you. Thank you. From the Ken Barr Theater at the Friends Center for the Arts in San Francisco, California, welcome to Says You, a simple game with words played by two teams, the first of which sits stereo right. Writer, performer, the prince of pronouns, Barry Nolan. Arts aficionada and adverb advocate, Francine Akbar. And radio icon, voice for the ages, the old gray dangling participle himself, Mr. Tony Khan. That was the annual greeting, Tony.
Oh, thank you, Richard. In honor of which, I'll captain.
You will be the captain.
Yeah, thank you.
To my left, team two, columnist, critic, pun, and funster, Carolyn Fay Fox. Consultant, public speaker, the laugh you long to hear, Paula Lyons. And producer, documentarian, playwright, scribe, toastmaster, bon vivant, and raconteur, the totally exhausted Mr. Arnie Raisman. And who's leading today?
I will be your captain.
The puns one, yes.
Carolyn will lead. Correct answers are worth 10 points or whatever fraction thereof deemed appropriate. We always advise new listeners to grab a pen and paper. Let's begin with a round of definitions and derivations. For 5 points, define, and for an additional 5, try to divine the origins of the following common words and phrases. Carolyn, fiasco.
Okay, a fiasco is it's a bad scene. It's when things go really wrong.
It right. is, in fact.
It this comes from
exploding pasta.
I was about to say, you know, an ancient grain.
Look at it, you know.
It does have that sound to it, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Fiasco.
Does it come from Latin?
No, not really.
Okay.
How so about is it Greek? Italian?
427 more to go. Guys.
Yes, that's. But you're narrowing it down.
We're narrowing it down.
Is it Italian?
It is, in fact, Italian.
I told you. Pasta.
It comes from opera.
It doesn't even come close to opera. No, it's
opera buffa.
Okay, come on, team.
No, it must have something to do with an Italian word that has something meaning about things being screwed up.
It does, actually. Yeah, okay. And that's
so
why you got
like,
6 points.
Well, like a salad.
Is it related to like a
something that failed?
It is something
like the takeover
that
of
something that has failed. Okay, some Italian automobile.
That's a fiasco.
Boy, those underwriting opportunities just drying up one after the other.
Says you, brought to you by Fiat.
Is it
like a failed attempt to take over the government, even?
No, that's not it. That's a great guess, though, aren't you? I'm going to give you six points and go to the other side. Any help by the side?
No. Is it culinary in any way? Like,
I'm sorry, I didn't
hear you. Is it culinary?
It is not. Well, no. Only in the...
Like tea with lemon and cream.
No. Nothing at all like that.
Anything to do with tragedy.
Anybody in the audience want to take a shot? A flask. We got a tough audience out there, folks. It is something gone badly wrong from the Italian metaphor when Venetian glassmakers would be producing something and they would see the slightest flaw, they would turn it into a fiasco, a common flask.
And that's
where that comes from.
So it comes from Glasgow.
From glassmakers.
And somebody out there knew that?
Yes. All right, try this one, Tony. Definition and derivation of egg on one's face.
Assuming that your attempt to accomplish something is to eat an egg, it's when it doesn't go in your mouth and it ends up on your face. This is a situation that's gone totally kablooey.
That's exactly
on you, and you're publicly embarrassed.
That's the best part, the public embarrassment.
Best part. Yeah.
Would it have anything to do with being pelted by eggs as a sign of being disapproved of?
It has absolutely everything to do with that.
So before somebody said, hey, why not a tomato?
Right.
Go to Barry.
It's something from the theater?
It's exactly from the English theater.
Eggs.
And it goes way back. This is 12th century England. When whatever shows they were doing out there, when poor stage actors were first subjected to that now time-honored tradition, they got eggs.
And that's when they first started posting signs that said, no outside food.
So the term a hard-boiled crowd really was one to fear.
Right.
Arnie, try this one.
Oh, please.
Definition and derivation of berserk.
Berserk.
Oh,
we should know. Is this something like Danish or something?
Well, it's up that way.
It's Nordic. And is it a way of like being distracting when you're going into battle or something? Wasn't it?
It
began with the military.
It does, actually. First of all, what's the definition?
Oh, going crazy, being out of control.
Yes.
It's like a Norwegian or Swedish word?
Yep, it's Nordic. It's from the Nordic. Okay.
So, and it resembles something else. Is that what you're trying to tell
me? Well, yeah, I think so.
Berserk.
Did you burst out?
No. You're definitely 7 points there. You got where it comes from, and you got the definition. And you do know that it's about battle. It's really about battle. Have we reached the end of your...
Apparently. Hello? Yeah. Anyone else here on the table? Anyone
on the other side?
A Viking stage direction?
A Viking stage direction. Yeah. Enter Berserk.
Yes.
Right. Well, enter stage left. Berserk.
Berserk.
Well, we said bear.
Berserk. Is it have anything to do with bear?
Yes. Absolutely.
Bear. Yes.
Very good, Tony. It is bear shirt.
Berserk
is Nordic for bear shirt. Worn by the fiercest Nordic warriors into battle, but more likely a metaphor for their savagery and all that. But there are also references to warriors wearing wolf coats into battle to channel the vicious ferocity of a wolf attack, you know, and they were wearing a bear shirt.
And some of them just grabbed a hold of the bear itself, held it up, and ran like crazy.
Enter left.
Try this one, Francine. Threshold.
Threshold.
Well, a threshold is the piece of... flooring between one room and another, where the doorway occurs.
Okay.
Where it occurs?
Where the doorway occurs, yes.
Yes,
you know, there should
doorway.
Be a doorway occurring about now.
No.
I'm expecting a window in about a minute after that.
I'm going to hazard that where it comes from has something to do with threshing.
It has a lot to do with that.
And perhaps it has to do with division of space in a
barn.
When you put in one of the things they would do before they had wall-to-wall carpeting is they would throw down the threshes in the house. Because it would absorb all manner of sins, and you could gather it up, throw it out, put down fresh thresh. And the threshold would hold it in the room and stop it from spilling outside or into the adjoining room.
I think we found his category. That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
And that just about says it.
Wow. Whoa.
Try this one, Paula. I liked finding out about this, so I hope you do too. Definition and derivation of bite the bullet.
Bite the bullet.
Ooh, that's so up my alley. Bite the bullet means it may be an unpleasant task, but do it anyway.
That's 5 points.
So, did they bite bullets in the old days to determine if they were real or filled with lead? No, that would have been very bad.
You wouldn't want to shoot somebody with a fake bullet.
Somebody else had to tell you.
That would be bad.
Would it be that someone would bite the bullet if they were wounded and someone was tending to their wounds?
That's what I always thought.
Yeah.
And they say no.
No.
They say no because
the audience says yes.
Yeah. And who's in charge?
Yeah.
That would be fine were this a democracy, but no. That's what I thought it was. I always thought it was when you went into surgery on the battlefield and the pain was going to be terrible. They put a bullet in your mouth when you bit on it. But then, of course, as they bring up in the literature, that would be kind of stupid. There'd be a lot of people swallowing bullets. But it really doesn't come from there. It's another derivation. Give it a shot.
Well, is it?
Give it a shot.
You are familiar with the general content of this show, right? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, I'm someone who's literally never seen a gun unless it was on a policeman. Yeah. So I have no idea how they work, nor do I particularly want to know. So I'd hope it's not too literal.
First of all, is it literal? That's what my question would be. Or is
yeah, it is.
It is literal.
It's pretty literal.
Okay, and it has nothing to do with, like, you know.
Is this being shot in the face and it's unpleasant, but do it anyway? I mean, what?
Be fast enough to bite the bullet before the bullet goes through you?
Just catch it between your teeth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tony has a theory.
Go ahead, Tony.
Well, but it's not our question.
Well, they've got...
Oh, it's okay. We give you permission.
Have they bit the whatever?
I think they have seeded.
I have an image that comes from a movie around colonial times when you had to ram the powder. In order to get the powder before you could fire the bullet, you'd have to get it out of the bullet pouch. And often the best way to do that was to rip it with your teeth and then pour it in like that.
You know something?
That's right.
He's exactly right.
Yeah.
He is exactly right.
Well, there you are.
I thought it was the surgery, the battlefield surgery, but it isn't. It refers to a soldier biting off the end of the paper cartridge to pour gunpowder down the barrel of the musket in preparation for firing. And you might imagine that salty, unpleasant taste preceding quite dangerous action.
And it also took half an hour, which means that when you're standing there exposed in the field, your chances of...
And didn't they all die of lead poisoning or something? I mean,
yeah, well, it was saltpeter. It was all kinds of terrible stuff.
So how many points do we get?
We got seven.
You got seven points for that. And finally, Barry, the definition and derivation of big stick diplomacy.
Oh.
A big stick diplomacy was... Teddy Roosevelt... Oh. Great quote, speak softly and carry a big stick.
That's, you know where he got it? By any chance?
Where did Teddy Roosevelt get his idea of a big stick?
Yeah, it's
because he had seen
the promised
Aboriginal
land.
People who were chiefs who didn't say much but had large staffs, and when people got out of line, there was a quick.
Well, you know what? On one of his safaris.
I was going to say
in the African safaris.
Hunting.
West African proverb: hunting. Speak softly and carry a big stick, and you will go far. The one thing you're missing is what is the definition, of course, of big stick diplomacy?
Have a lot of tanks.
Intimidate.
When you are ready to make a point, show up with overwhelming force.
Good enough for me. 10 points. Nice job. It is. Foreign policy based on the real or threatened use of superior force on a weakened opponent. And that's what it is. Very good, you guys. Nice round of definitions and derivations. Hope you all learned a little something. And let's go on to round two, which is played with a little musical help from our friends, the Caesar Swing Trio. It's the first of the Says You Bluffing rounds. Carolyn, each of you will receive a card defining the word. Only one will have the actual definition. The other will have cards that say, please bluff. Those poor souls have a few seconds to make up a definition on the spot good enough to fool Tony's team. 10 points are up for grabs to Tony if he can sniff out the bluffers, or to you, Carolyn, if he can't. A few seconds to come up with a definition for the word staboy.
Staboy?
S-T-A-B-O-Y. Staboy.
Stopping at the staboy.
Folks. Says You's caravan of cajolery stops next in Hartford, Connecticut, Friday night, October 12th, for a live performance at the University of Hartford. Then the next weekend, Saturday, October 20th, it's on to the Dairy State for some constant badgering at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. In November, we invade Syracuse, New York for our salute to the Salt City, November 16th and 17th. And finally, on December 30th, we're back in Boston to end the year, and if legend is correct, all of history, with the performance we call In the Great Mayan Bay. Tickets, information, and details are available at saysyou.net. That's S-A-Y-S-Y-O-U, where if you follow that Join the Fun link, we'll show you how to join the fun. Says You returns after this from home. You can hear Says You again for free on any of the stations that stream our show. Just follow the High Definitions radio stations link on our website, find a convenient time, and listen again and again. For copies of this show or any other in our history, you can find downloads at saysyou.net. Just follow that show downloads link and find high quality copies available. Sazer, Swing Trio. That's Miss Irene Sazer on violin and vocals, Eric Pearson on the guitar, and Daniel Fabricant on the bass. Thanks, guys. Let's take a moment and thank our scorekeepers. That's Jaina Fishman from Sacramento and Mr. Ian Martin from San Ramon. Thanks, guys, for keeping the score. We have had a few moments with the word staboy. We will go first to Carolyn Faye Fox.
Is it a boy or is it a girl?
I have no idea.
Actually, it reminds me of a young boy who's a chimney sweep, because a staboy is an abrasive substance used to clean chimneys.
An abrasive substance used to clean chimneys.
Mm-hmm.
Is staboy? Could be that. Sounds logical. Or Arnie, something else?
Well, I was, I guess, pronouncing it wrong because I thought it was originally a command to keep a dog from roaming, but it's actually nothing more than a three-legged milking stool.
Ooh.
How you get milk out of it, I have no idea.
Don't do that anymore, please.
There's a splinter in my drink.
Did you hear that? A titter ran through the audience. Yes. I've never actually heard that before. That was a three-legged milking stool.
Yeah.
Could be what a staboy is, or Paula something else.
Well, see, Arnie just didn't know how right he was about this dog command, but it's kind of the opposite of what he was talking about, because it's a shout that hunters use to encourage their dogs to keep chasing that wascally wabbit or fox or whatever it is.
What breed?
What breed? What breed of dog?
Yes.
I have no idea. What is a hunting
person?
Dog?
What breed of person? Yeah.
What breed of rabbit?
What breed of person?
Yes, I know. Staboy.
So it's a hunter's shout to encourage the dog?
To keep Stay on boy. Keeping on.
Staboy, staboy. Oh,
staboy. Yes.
Staboy, staboy.
Okay, could be that. It is either a hunter's shout to encourage the dog, a three-legged milking stool, or an abrasive substance for chimney cleaning.
Yes.
It's one of those three, and the choice, Tony, is yours.
Yes. Well, could be, maybe not. I believe the abrasive substance used to clean chimneys is a chimney sweep. And so it's a very, very thin, young, unfortunate boy.
I find them highly abrasive.
Yeah. And I don't really think of them as abrasive. I think of them as unfortunate.
Well, the question is...
They do use tools.
Well, moving on.
Yes,
I think the hunter shout possibility, because it sounds almost Russian, you know, staboy.
Staboy, chick.
And staboy in Russian actually does mean something, but it means with you, so that's not related at all. That's why it may be right. And the three-legged milking stool, I think that's the right answer. Because it reminds me of a joke my father used to tell. This is really
so
how
scientific.
We figured this out, folks. He taught this when I was a kid. He said that there's this guy sitting in a train, and every time they pass by some cows, he comes up with a number, 536. And the next time, 2012. The guy sitting next to him says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm counting the cows." He says, "How can you do it that fast?" He says, "I count the legs and divide by four." So?
Which leads you to the milking stool.
So it's a three-legged milking stool, I think.
Where's a drummer when you need one?
Yeah, exactly.
But a boom.
Tony, I'm with you because I see there's no reasoning with you.
or from me.
Yes.
You're going to the idea of stable.
Yeah.
Stabile.
There you go.
Stabile.
A stabile stool.
Okay.
Which sounds awfully medical to me.
We're not arguing, are we?
No.
No. We are supporting you.
We're going with number two, the gentleman in the middle, Mr. Reisman.
Mr. Reisman, the team goes with you. They say that staboy is a three-legged milking stool. Is that, in fact, what it is?
Staboy. Please fake a definition.
They've been killing you with those. They're just killing
well,
you.
Not the first time an elaborate theory has proven totally wrong.
That's true. That was a bluff. 10 points for your team, Arnie. All right, audience, it's your turn. What do you think?
Dog.
How many think the dog call?
How many think the chimney cleaner? All right. Actually, I think, Paula, the dog encouragement has ruled the day there. Is that, in fact, what Staboy is?
Staboy, a cry for encouraging to hunting dogs in pursuit of prey.
There you go, good audience. Lord. That's your 10 points.
Is that an image?
It's what it is. Let's go on to round three. Wayne Goodman of Vallejo, California. Here's us courtesy the good folks at KQED here in San Francisco. He's come up with a category we call Reading Rainbow. The names of many colors have evocative and interesting origins. Grab your crayons and see if you can figure out what color we have in mind. Carolyn, this pigment, derived from lapis lazuli, traveled from Asia to the West. So the Latin for beyond the sea.
Cerulean.
No.
No?
Was applied to
Aquamarine.
Not aquamarine, beyond the sea.
Beyond the sea. Ultramarine.
Ultramarine.
Yeah. There you go, 10 points. Right. Ultramarine is correct. Try this one, Tony. The French word for cherry is perfect for this color.
Cerise.
Cerise is exactly right. Well, you guys are going to nail this category, I think. Try this one, Arnie. This hue got its name from a town near Milan, where a battle in 1859, the same year it was invented, left the ground red with blood.
Siena.
Siena, yeah.
No.
No?
No. Umbra?
No.
Oh.
This hue got its name from a town near Milan, where a battle in 1859 left the ground red with blood.
So Maruno.
Maroon, is it? It's hardly burgundy or...
It's
scarlet,
umber.
They're going rose. Through everything, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
What could that be?
Ochre.
No, it is not.
No.
Well, that's not the right
it's
color.
It's not terracotta because that's not red.
No.
Red with blood.
It would have to be that kind of color, though. Blood on the ground.
Blood on the ground.
Not crimson.
Crimsoni?
Crimsoni.
I think they've gone through just about every color on the palette at this point, but...
burnt umbria.
No, it is not.
Hemoglobino.
aren't you ashamed of yourself? Aren't you just ashamed?
You went past maroon.
Corpuscolino, right.
Yeah, corpuscolino. Yeah. Anybody in the audience want to take a shot? Magenta.
Boy, that doesn't even look like
that's
blood.
That's pink. That's
magenta
pink. Magenta's pink.
All right. Okay. Sorry that this one is next, but it just is.
No.
Try this one, Francine. This earth tone takes its name from the Italian region from which it's unearthed.
Well, there we go.
Umbria.
Umbria, but when the color is, of course...
Burnt umbria.
Or
burnt
umber. Yes, that's correct. I'm so sorry about that.
Yeah.
It's going to happen more and more during this category, but we'll move on. Paula?
Yes.
Apparently, Europeans were looking closely at their animals when they named this color. It's Latin for flea.
Puce.
Puce, good. Puce.
Very good, Carolyn. That's very good.
Very good.
Puce. The Latin for flea, of course, being pulex.
Pulex.
Yeah, P-U-L-E-X. And finally, and this is the hardest one, so give it a shot, Barry. There was a green hue... associated with the country of Greece.
Nope.
Hence, in Old English, it is the words for green and Greece. What color might we have in mind?
Green and... Francine, you're...
Amber Greece. It's several colors, actually.
Yeah. Amber Greece.
It's Greek for...
Verdigris. Very good, Miss Ackley.
Very good.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, as a colorblind person, can you tell me, what does verdigris actually look like?
It's hard to describe color to a colorblind person.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
It looks just like you don't know.
I'll tell you what it looks like. It looks like old, unpolished copper.
Yes.
Does that tell you anything?
Yes, it does, actually. I actually can see green.
Coming, as I do, from Ottawa, Canada, where the parliament buildings have copper roofs, and when they let the copper roofs go, they turn verdigris.
Verdigris. Oh, interesting. Another interesting fact.
A gray-green.
That you will only hear on Says You. That's it.
This week's Spotlight Round comes at the request of none other than CSU's own Benjamin Scherr. Seems that Ben's class has been studying U.S. geography this term. Principal in that discussion, state capitals. Every time we uncover a new fact, he says, "Dad, that'd make a great CSU question." Well, Ben and his class will be listening this week, testing their mettle against guest panelist Lenore Shannon and our gang as we go back to Season 3, when we first played that round we call A Capital Idea. Simply answer the following questions. Carolyn, what four state capitals have the word city as part of the name?
Four state capitals? Yeah. I've got to give you four capitals.
Well, Missouri is Jefferson City.
Jefferson City.
Oklahoma is Oklahoma City.
It is?
You go, guy. Dodge City?
No.
Dodge City is incorrect.
I don't know these things. Kansas City, no, right? Kansas.
You have Jefferson City, Oklahoma City.
I did terribly at
any help
Carson
from
City, Nevada.
Carson City, Nevada.
Yes, that's number three.
Okay. Well, that's what we needed. Three cities,
no,
right?
Now you need four. Anyone know the fourth
Carson
one?
City.
What's Wyoming?
The fourth one, of course, is Salt Lake.
Salt Lake City.
City. They get the hard ones. They don't get the easy ones.
We got three of the hard ones, right?
Tony, the four capitals named after a U.S. president.
Well, I'd like to go on record as saying that I don't like state capitals.
Yeah.
I think they're oversold and the hotel beds are lumpy.
I've already...
Well, let's see. You got Washington.
No.
D.C. That's a
state capital.
Well, there's Lincoln.
Lincoln,
there's
Nebraska.
Jefferson City.
That's right.
Jefferson.
That's two.
I get to
Lincoln,
reuse
Jefferson.
An answer that we already had.
Madison is three.
Madison,
Wisconsin.
And
you have to look south for this one.
Oh, good. Give him a clue.
Whether Jackson.
Is exactly right.
Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi, Jefferson City, Missouri, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Madison, Wisconsin. Arnie, the four state capitals that have the letter U twice.
U twice.
Now, if this were Norway.
That's good. Right,
Augusta, Maine.
Augusta, Maine is one.
Augusta, Maine.
Very good.
Any help from that side?
Is Duluth a capital?
No, it is not. But probably
with
should
two
be.
Two U's in them.
Chicago?
Right, Augusta?
I think we got a stumper here.
Why would a state capital need two U's anyway?
Any help from the audience?
Tallahassee?
Columbus
is one.
Oh, Columbus.
Honolulu is another.
Yeah. Hey, very
and
good.
And Juneau is the third. Very good. Juneau, Augusta, Columbus, and Honolulu. We'll give them 4 points for that. Lenore,
right.
Four states and their capitals that begin with the same letter.
Four states and their capitals that begin with the same letter.
Oh, I knew.
Okay, guys, jump in at any time.
Honolulu, Hawaii.
Honolulu, Hawaii is one.
Juneau, Alaska.
Gosh, you got to think really fast on this one, don't you?
Well, no, it's not New York. Newark, New Jersey.
Newark, New Jersey.
New Jersey is another one.
Trenton is it? Yeah.
That's a blank slate over there.
It's a blank slate over there.
Any help from the other side?
Philadelphia,
Pennsylvania.
No, it's not. It's Harrisburg.
It is Harrisburg.
Never mind.
Any help from the audience?
Oklahoma City,
Dover, Delaware, and Indianapolis, Indiana.
Indiana.
Wow.
This one, I'm just, I want to start a controversy with this. Paula, what two state capitals are the most populous and what two are the least?
Wow, state capitals
that
are most populous.
Oh, gosh, wait a minute now.
Well,
the least populous would be in one of those states like South Dakota or.
That would be one.
Yeah. Pierce, South Dakota.
Pierce, South Dakota is one.
Is Denver now up to the...
No, that's not up to most.
We're going to have a controversy here on the high
end. Oh, is it...
Phoenix.
Phoenix is another one, yes. Phoenix is one of the two most populated. You're missing a neighbor as being one of the least populated.
Montpelier
is the least, yes.
So Montpelier and Pierre
are the least.
And Phoenix.
And here's the controversy. They say Sacramento.
Really?
And yes, I find that difficult to believe. And if that is incorrect, I want the audience to help me with this. That's what we got from Rand McNally.
Really? I would bet.
And finally,
Denver,
Barry, what are the northernmost, southernmost, easternmost, and westernmost state capitals?
Oh. The what?
Northernmost. That's got to be a trick. So Alaska must not. Is it?
Well, Juneau, Alaska certainly would be in the northern.
Yes, Juneau is right. Not everything in
Alaska. Okay, the southernmost
is Hawaii southernmost?
Texas. Austin?
No.
Honolulu?
Honolulu is correct.
The easternmost has got to be Maine.
Augusta
is correct.
And the westernmost would be Juneau
again?
No, it is not.
Oh, the westernmost.
Unless it's Honolulu.
Where are we going?
Yes, the westernmost is Honolulu. That is correct. Juneau is north. Honolulu is both south and west, and Augusta is east. That's our spotlight round for this week. If there's a memorable moment you haven't heard in years, let us know. We'll send our crack staff into the archives and do our best to find your favorite. You can register your choice at SaysYou.net. That's SaysYou. That's our look back. Now, back to the present. Let's go on to round four, which is Tony's team's chance to have a little fun at Webster's expense. One of you will correctly define the following word. Two will bluff. 10 points, Carolyn, if your team can find the rose among thorns. Take a few seconds to come up with a definition for the word popination.
Popination.
P-O-P-I-N-A-T-I-O-N. Popination.
It's Mary's fan club.
Yes.
Well, could be. Folks? Just a quick reminder, SaysYou performs live this fall on Friday, October 12th in Hartford, Connecticut, on Saturday, October 20th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, November 16th and 17th in Syracuse, New York, and December 30th at Regis College in Weston, Massachusetts. Tickets, information, and details for all SaysYou performances are available at SaysYou.net. That's SaysYou. And we hope you can join us this fall for a live performance of SaysYou. Briefly, SaysYou pauses, just long enough for a few interstitial announcements. We'll be right back. You coming to our town? Where can I find old shows? Who played that music I heard last week? So many questions, all answered on our website at SaysYou.net. There you can find tickets to tapings, Dally on the Daily Dispatch, or access our complete archive. You can contribute a question to the show and absorb ridicule on a national scale. This and more at SaysYou.net. That's SaysYou.
Scott Sazer, Swing Trio.
Thank you very much, guys. We've had a few moments with the word popination. We will go first to Tony Khan.
Well, Richard, I have, you might say, introductory definitions, one of which I hope you can include in the show.
Fine.
Popination is rubbing up against someone in a movie theater. Maybe?
Do you want to explain that once more?
I don't think it would be necessary, actually.
What I want to explain is, how does this occur to you? I'm just
out of sheer despair, because I didn't know what else to think of. Well, because the definition is actually making an insulting gesture.
Making an insulting gesture.
Yes.
Like, pop you, Jack.
Is to popinate, so you would popinate is to make an insulting gesture, popination.
Yeah.
That could be it. What say you, Francine?
Well, it goes more to the idea of populating, and populating certain kind of establishments, and it's actually sort of a pub crawl.
It's sort of a pub
crawl?
Sort
of a pub crawl? It says sort of a pub crawl?
Sort of a pub crawl.
That's the vague dictionary of vagal definition.
Yeah, right.
Kind of
vaguely crawling toward pubs.
Reminiscent of
populating drinking establishments.
From what? Webster's Third Vagary.
Populating drinking establishments.
Populating drinking establishments?
Yes.
It's the act of populating drinking establishments?
Yes, it's
pretty much.
Population.
Yes, Arnie.
It could be that, or
that's
Barry, what say you?
Popination is a method of grafting orchids. You may recall Paul Dooley in American Graffiti saying, if you take her to the prom, just be home before there's any popination. Popination is a method of grafting orchids.
Grafting.
It could grafting. Be a method of grafting orchids, going from one drinking establishment to another, or making an insulting gesture. It is one of those three, and the choice, Carolyn, falls to you.
Any of them.
Yeah, right. Try again. But we have three more.
Yeah.
Getting egg on your face while you're biting the bullet, going berserk on a threshold with a big stick.
I think Barry was thinking about pollination. So yeah. I might rule out grafting orchids.
I'm liking that pub crawl.
I know. The pub crawl suddenly looks good. Either that or I want to do it and get away. That's one thing.
Well, it's either
there's
that
no
or
rhyme, no reason, of course.
Or making an insulting gesture.
Well, like popping a finger or something?
Something like that. Like get popped.
Get popped. Yeah, but this doesn't... Get popped is slang, and this doesn't look like a slang.
Right. No, it doesn't, does it? So
well,
what do you think, Team?
I don't know. I'm going with Paula here. I kind of like...
We just like it. We don't know if it's right.
All right.
We like it.
Well, sure. We'll go with Francine then.
Francine, they have come to the conclusion that popination is some sort of pub crawl. Is that what it is?
Bar hopping.
Yay!
That is what it is.
Wow.
10 points.
Oh. Wow. Bar hopping.
Yep. Popination is bar hopping.
Wow. Let's go on to round 5. Let's close tonight. Margie and Peter Sharon, who all say hi to you guys.
Margie and Peter.
Hi.
Yeah, Margie and Peter Sharon of Boston, Massachusetts, check back in this week with another round of famous first lines. Oh. I'll give you the first line of a famous work of literature. 7 points if you can tell me the name of the work. 3 more for the author. Ooh. An example, of course, Call Me Ishmael.
Yes. Moby Dick. Moby Dick.
Moby Dick. Mr.
Herman by Moby. Dick Moby.
Fine. 15 years. 15 years.
Herman Melville by... Oh, never mind.
That's how about it. Almost 30?
Yeah. Try this one, Carolyn.
All right.
There was no possibility of taking a walk that day.
Of taking a walk?
I think that's Ulysses, isn't it?
There was no possibility of taking a walk that day.
No, it's not Ulysses.
There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. It was a dark and stormy night.
There was no possibility of taking a walk that day.
Oh, this is. I thought you would know this.
Is it Harry Potter?
It is not. That's that Lymington Crescent or whatever it is, Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, that's right. Right, yeah. Right, yes.
There was no possibility of taking a walk.
I just thought Carolyn would know this.
Carolyn,
I'm so sorry.
Is it some kind of children's classic?
It is not a children's classic.
Right. Oh, I have an idea.
There was no possibility of taking a walk.
Take a blind, wild guess.
I'm just drawing a complete blank here.
Okay. A complete blank.
A complete blank.
Does the other side
yes,
have...
Yes, it's the opening of the guillotine scene.
Nuts. I knew we were going nowhere fast here.
Yeah, no, we do have a hunch here.
It's not pressing. Virginia Woolf, is it?
It is not.
No. Mrs. Dalloway's.
No.
Oh, I'm so sorry about this. Audience, do you have a thought? No, I think I heard it in the back there. It is. It's Jane Eyre.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh,
and Charlotte Bronte.
Oh.
I should have said it.
Yep.
I
really thought you were going to get it, Carolyn. I'm so sorry.
He's apologizing.
I'm terribly sorry, too, Richard.
Try this one, Tony. Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents. Oh.
Said, it's the subject of a wonderful biography written by my wife, Harriet Risen, called Louisa May Alcott, The Real Woman Behind Little Women. And it's the beginning of Little Women.
It is the beginning of Little Women, and it's Louisa May Alcott.
Handed it to a woman.
And that's why I gave it to you. Because if you haven't seen...
And an important film on public television.
Right. If you haven't seen Harriet's piece, you really should see it. It's
great
wonderful.
Book and a wonderful PBS documentary that was on American Masters. And will be again.
Try this one, Arnie. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13.
Oh, my God. It's,
is it 1984, Animal Farm?
No, it's...
Clockwork Orange?
No. Wait a minute. Is this Thurber?
No.
It is. Okay, let me have to get that out of my head. And the clocks were striking 13. So, is it 1984?
It's 1984.
George Orwell.
Orwell.
Yeah, that is.
1984. Whoa. And that one you knew. Good job on that one. Try this one, Francine. It was a pleasure to burn.
Oh.
It was a pleasure to burn.
Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I guess so. The autobiography of Joan of Arc.
No, it is not the
autobiography.
Well, I knew that. Thank you. Thank you, Bert.
It was just a guess.
It was a pleasure to burn. Okay, it's either ironic. Is this the devil talking?
Oh, is this Fahrenheit?
Fahrenheit 451.
451.
By
Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
Oh.
That's what it is. It is Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. Try this one, Paula.
No, I'm the person, you know, who buys the same book twice because she doesn't remember what she read. Good luck to me.
It was the best of times. It was the best of times.
It was the best of times.
But give it a shot.
This is a... And this is a really tough one, too.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I'm so sorry about
beautiful.
This. In the late summer of that year, we lived in a house in a village that looked across the river and the plain to the mountains.
Yes.
It's got to be some Willa Caffa thing, don't you think?
Sounds like it.
In the late summer of that year, we lived in a house in a village that looked across the river and the plain to the mountains.
It's not Little House on the Prairie, I'm sure. is it Willa Caffa?
It is not Willa Caffa.
Oh.
Okay. I think I'm done.
You go. Give it a shot. Give it a shot.
Is it a female author?
I'll give you that hint. No, it is not a female author.
Okay, then.
Okay. So, it's a male author.
All right. Or something in between.
Yeah. Tony, do you really do you know this?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, boy. Tony knows.
Oh, my gosh.
Tony.
I am so sorry. Tony, give it a shot.
Paula?
Well, I was going to give it a shot.
Say it again. It's Ernie.
Say it
again.
Ernie wants a shot.
One more time.
One more time.
Oops, I already
I'm sorry.
Said it.
Oh. Did you hear what he said?
No.
Okay, let me give it one more time. In the late summer of that year, lived in a house in a village that looked across the river and the plain to the mountains.
Now, go ahead, Tony. Go ahead.
Ernest Hemingway, Farewell to Arms.
That's
right?
What it is.
Ernest
Hemingway. That's a very long sentence for Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
No wonder we didn't get it.
Very good. Very good. And no points for that, I'm sorry. And finally, Barry, he was an inch, perhaps two, under 6 feet, powerfully built, and he advanced straight at you with a slight stoop of the shoulders, head forward, and a fixed from under stare that made you think of a charging bull.
Is that Fitzgerald?
Of Mice and Men?
It's neither of those.
Yeah. It's not F. Scott Fitzgerald.
No, it is not.
And it's not, and it's not Faulkner.
No, it isn't.
But it's the story of a big guy.
It's.
I read that book. I can't get it.
Well, he was an inch or two under 6 feet, powerfully built, certainly.
Yeah.
And he advanced straight at you with a slight stoop of the shoulders, head forward, and a fixed from under stare made you think of a charging bull.
Yeah, right.
Anybody on the other side? No.
And it's not Fitzgerald.
No. I'm going to go to the audience. Audience, what do you think? No, it is Joseph Conrad, Lord Jim.
Lord Jim.
Oh.
Wow.
A tough one to end, but it didn't matter today. Today, it was Tony's team's chance. It was an 80-70 victory. Winners this week. Congratulations. That is all we have time for in San Francisco. Thanks so much to Lenore Naxon, Geese Graphics, and all the folks here at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Also to Joanne Wallace, Robin Smith, and everybody at KQED for their long friendship. Sharon Salkind are the writers. Antonio Oliart mans the meters. Zach Moore is the associate producer and webmaster. We take our leave from the city by the bay, recalling the words of Walter Cronkite, who once said that leaving San Francisco is like saying goodbye to an old sweetheart. You just want to linger as much as possible. That's what we'd like to do. We can't wait to get back. But for now, thanks for the great time, San Francisco, and we'll see you all next week.
Seju in San Francisco comes from the good folks at KQED FM and the Intercontinental Hotels, the Intercontinental Mark Hopkins, and the Intercontinental San Francisco, our home away from home on the bay and on the web at intercontinentalsanfrancisco.com. The skinny.
Says you. Created and produced by Pippin and Finch, Boston.
We know that the light and smells in places like hospitals and airports can depress us, and that our favorite room in our house helps keep us sane. Science is now demonstrating why physical spaces stress us, make us sick, or help us be well. I'm Krista Tippett. That's the next On Being. Please join me from APM.
Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Celebrating 50 years of community service and community support, this is 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule of all our programs and listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. It's 10 o'clock.